Well, good morning, everyone. Lovely to see you all here for what's going to be a fascinating talk about the ERB. I'm just going to very briefly introduce the bill and our wonderful speakers, and they're all going to speak for about 10 minutes each. Now, I mean, you know that we've got this mega bill coming down the track. It's certainly big. Whether it's beautiful is another matter. 300 pages and quite wide-ranging reforms, and you'll hear a bit about it in a moment. Zero-hours contracts, fire and rehire, strike, balloting and so forth. But what's really striking about this bill is the lack of coherent narrative. And there was no white paper that preceded the bill. The bill was rushed out in the first 100 days. And I think what you might say is it's a bill of bits and pieces, some bits better than others. Now, I think this lack of coherent vision, I think, is problematic. I've talked in the past about it being a bill that fixes potholes. In other words, it deals with problems in the past, but in no way is it forward-looking. And I think the most obvious lack is anything about algorithmic management, which is clearly an emerging issue. And this contrasts very unfavourably with the EU, which has got the Platform Work Directive and is now looking at other forms of regulation for those working online. So to me, this bill feels very 20th century rather than 21st century. So the bill's in six parts, 12 schedules. I think it introduces 25 or so new rights, possibly 24 and a half in the light of the changes announced this week about day one rights. The drafting is, in my view, dreadful. It's brilliantly complicated, but it means it's brilliantly complicated, which is marvellous for small businesses. And it will lead to litigation, although we're going to hear something about that in a moment. And do bear in mind the enormous pressure tribunals already under cases in London and the South East are now being listed into 2029, which is an absolute disgrace in terms of access to justice. It's also expected that there's going to be 80 plus pieces of secondary legislation. And so this bill builds complexity upon complexity. And remember, of course, it's meant to be for large and small businesses and for employees. So it's an extremely complicated, difficult bill. And most people are, I'm afraid, very negative about it. Now, we are very fortunate today to have some marvellous people. John Hendy, Lord Hendy KC, is going to start. Labour peer. And very big trade union lawyer. He's made his career advising trade unions. So I think it's fair to say you're coming from the left of the party. And then he's going to be followed by Nick Dennis, who's from the Law Society. And in his spare time, he's a Conservative councillor. And so you'll get a different flavour coming from him. And then you'll have input from FOTUS, who obviously you all know very well, who will offer his own marvellous and unique take. So, John, the floor is yours. Do you want to take it? Do you want to come up here?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much. Morning, everybody. Catherine has asked us, well, asked me anyway, to say a few things about what I like about the bill, and then a few things about the things that I don't like about the bill. So I'll deal with those points in that order. I'm not going to focus on the technical details that are in the 300 pages. I'm going to look at the broader picture. So thinking about things that are really good about this bill, the first thing, obviously, is the fact that there's a bill at all. The Labour Party have proclaimed this as the greatest uplift in workers' rights for a generation. And there's no doubt they're right about that, because there hasn't been an uplift in workers' rights in the last two generations. So no question that's a correct. The fact that they've addressed it at all is a good thing. The second thing that's good about it is that they try to address some of the really major problems for working people today. Fire and rehire, which I know you've already discussed in earlier sessions, 0 hours contracts, access for trade unions to workplaces and so on. All these things have been addressed, and the creation of a Fair Work Agency to create a statutory labour inspectorate with power to intervene to enforce the legislation. Those are very good things. Bad things about the bill, first of all, is the point that Catherine made. None of the issues which are addressed in the bill, I think, are likely to be very successful. They're sort of half measures that don't really get to the end of the job. But the four points that I want to make to you, the four negative points fundamentally are these. One, it does not address the legal status of workers. Now, that is a crucial omission. The issue of a single status for working people is the single most important topic in individual labour law today. When we sat down in 2021, Keir Starmer invited Andy MacDonald MP to chair a working group consisting mostly of trade union people to come up with the labour law policy that would be implemented should Labour win the next election. And that was the New Deal for Working People. I was the honorary legal advisor on that group, and it sets out what the Labour Party ought to do about labour law. It was endorsed by the Labour Conference in 2021 and again re-endorsed in 2022. And Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner and the rest of the front bench spent 2 years advocating the New Deal for working people. That New Deal was moderated a little bit before the general election, and this bill was meant to implement the New Deal for working people. It comes nowhere near the doing the things that the New Deal for working people invited or proposed that the Labour Party should do in power, and in power with a substantial majority in the House of Commons. And one of the things that we advocated was a single status for working people. Get rid of the various subcategories that we've got now. You know all about this stuff, I'm sure. The genuine employee, the LIMBY worker, the self-employed worker, the full self-employed worker, the worker employed by a personal service company, and so on. Get rid of the whole shooting match except for those who are genuinely in business on their own account. That would be a category of self-employment that would be preserved. All other workers would be entitled to all statutory and common law rights as a worker, because that's the significance, of course, of the status of workers. Depending on which status you fall into, that will decide which employment rights you are entitled to. And the failure of the bill to address that right at the beginning means that one of the consequences of this legislation is that employers will now be sitting down working out how to move their employees into LIMBY status so they get less of the new employment rights, and how they convert LIMBY workers into self-employed workers so they get none of the new rights. That's what employment lawyers engaged by employers are now addressing. That's what they're trying to work out now, is how to change the categories of workers. And that is exactly what will happen. If they find that unfair dismissal or guaranteed hours is too much of a burden, then they'll change the relationship with the workers. So that's my point number one. Doesn't address status of workers. The second point is that it doesn't do what the New Deal for Working People put right at the heart of its proposals. That was to reintroduce a legal mechanism for a sectoral collective bargaining. That is to say, collective bargaining on an industry-wide basis, setting minimum terms and conditions for that industry on which enterprise bargaining could then improve particular aspects of relevance to that particular enterprise. What you've got to remember, the labor historians amongst you will recall, that between the Second World War and 1980, 80% of workers in Britain were covered by a collective agreement. They may not have been members of the union that negotiated it, and their employer may not have been a member of the employers' association on the other side of those negotiations, but their employment was covered by a collective agreement. 80%. In fact, in 1975, it was 85% of British workers covered by collective agreements. Now, there's some controversy about what the figure is today, but in my estimation, it's around 25% of workers now covered. That's one in four. And think of the other three of those four workers. Their terms and conditions are decided unilaterally by employers. No negotiation, no consultation, no power on the worker's side to vary. It's take it or leave it. And it's interesting to recall, you guys have probably dealt with this already, but there's a adequate minimum wage directive from the European Union, which was reviewed by the Court of Justice of the EU 2 weeks ago, which upheld a provision in that directive which requires every member state in the European Union which has less than 80% collective bargaining coverage to formulate an action plan to achieve 80% within 5 years of whenever the directive came out, 2023. So there's 3 years left for the EU states to come up to 80%. So the bill has no mechanism whatsoever for sectoral collective bargaining. It makes some changes to individual recognition machinery under Schedule A1 of the 1992 Act, but there's no mechanism for sectoral collective bargaining. It's true that the bill does provide for a negotiating body in adult social care and school support staff, but we can go into it in discussion if you're interested. No industrial relations expert, nor the International Labour Organization, or anybody else would ever consider that they are genuine collective bargaining bodies. In fact, the bill specifically states that they are not to be regarded as collective bargaining bodies as defined by Section 178 of the 1992 Act. Third area of criticism is the failure, again, to fulfill what we put in the New Deal for Working People, a positive right to strike and compliance of our industrial action law with the international treaty obligations which the United Kingdom has voluntarily undertaken to be in conformity with. And those are European Social Charter, Article 6.4, the Convention 87 of the International Labour Organization, and so on. There is nothing in the bill about conformity with international law and the measures that it does propose in relation to industrial action come nowhere near complying with our international obligations. And that's not just my personal view. Non-compliance has been declared by the ILO since 1989 on every occasion that the ILO has examined the conformity of the United Kingdom with its obligations under Convention 87. It has found that the UK is in breach. And again, if we need to do it, we can go into the detail of that in discussion. And the fourth and final area I wanted to draw to your attention is something I know Nick is going to talk in more detail about, but it's this, that the bill does not provide adequate remedies to enforce the rights that it is now granting to workers. And we can see this in many ways. The tribunal system, as Catherine intimated at the beginning, is in complete disarray. Cases listed in 2029 and so on. A third of all workers who achieve a financial compensation order in a tribunal, one third of them never see a single penny of their award. Another third only receive part of their award. This bill is not going to change that. It's true that it sets up a Fair Work Agency, and that's a very good thing, but we know what's going to happen to that Fair Work Agency. It's not going to have the resources needed to do the job. And how do we know that? Because you can look at the Health and Safety Executive, which has the similar task in relation to health and safety at work, and see how it has been underfunded and funding slashed over year after year. Number of inspectors halved from what they were in the HSE. I've got no doubt that the Fair Work Agency will not have the resources to carry out the job. And there are other aspects of remedies too. I won't take up anybody else's time. I'll just mention two very quickly. Access to workplaces by trade unions. Trade unions could seek an agreement with an employer for access. If they don't reach agreement or there's breach of the agreement, the union can take a case to the Central Arbitration Committee, and the Central Arbitration Committee can make an order for the union to have access to the workplace. And if the employer breaches that order, the trade union can go back to the CAC. But after that, there's nothing that the trade union can do in order to compel a compliance with the order. It can seek a fine on the employer, but the fine is not paid to the union as compensation for being shut out from its members at the workplace. The fine is payable to the Central Arbitration Committee. I can't see unions bothering with that. What was needed, and we put it in the Fair New Deal for Working People, is an injunction, the power to go to the High Court to say, Central Arbitration Committee have made this order, employer in breach of it, we want to commence contempt proceedings, if necessary, imprisoning the directors or sequestering the company's assets and so on. And the same is also true if you look at fire and rehire, obligations to consult over potential dismissals and so on. No effective enforcement mechanism. Again, we've been advocating use of an injunction to stop that, to compel employers to carry out their obligations under fire and rehire. But the bill doesn't do that, and amendments that I proposed in the House of Lords were rejected by the government. And it's important that that's important because you guys are probably all aware of the P&O Ferries case in 2023, where P&O Ferries sacked their entire British workforce at 7 o'clock in the morning, and admitted to the Committee on whatever it was, trade in the House of Commons, that they'd done it intentionally, knowing that it was in breach of their legal obligations. And they said they'd done it because they'd calculated the maximum award that could be held against them for non-consultation and unfair dismissal. And it was cheaper to pay that in full to all the workers and a little bit more to get rid of them, which because it could be recouped from the agency staff that they were taking on in their place. That's not good enough. What was required was an injunction to require the employers to comply with their obligations. That is what's missing from the bill. So as you see, I'm highly critical of this bill. I moved 29 amendments in the House of Lords to try and improve it, but I'm afraid the government wasn't with me on any of them. Thanks for listening.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody, and thank you for the invite to come here and talk about this bill. I'm going to start off sort of framing the bill, because I think one of the things that's really, really important about labour law, and one of the reasons I love labour law, is because it's more than law. Labour law is very economic and it's very political. And I think there are many good lawyers who can be good labour lawyers, but the best labour lawyers are the ones who understand that and get underneath what is the law and look at the economics and look at the politics. Work is really special because it straddles the public good and the private life. It's also something that everyone experiences. Anybody who's a labour lawyer, and if you go to a drinks party, by the end of the drinks party, you'll have people coming asking you for advice. That always happens. But I don't mind that because it's a lot more interesting than discussing my holidays with people. I quite like discussing people's issues when they come to you. But, you know, labour law is one of those areas where people, if they know you know about it, will want to talk to you about it. I'm sure some of you here probably have family members talking to you already about this and that has happened. But one of the things I think is really interesting about labour law and is not discussed as much as it should be is how the public good and the private sort of lives and contracts interact. Now, many people see the world of work both as a private thing and a public thing. So on the public thing, we've had things come out like the NDA and sexual harassment issue around Harvey Weinstein and Me Too and all that sort of stuff. We had the P&O fire and rehire, and I'll come back to that a little bit maybe. And of course, P&O started this debate about fire and rehire, but P&O was just about firing and gaming the system and saying, hey, if we pay this money, actually, we don't need to follow the law. And everyone seemed to be okay with that. Not everyone, but they got away with it, basically. Also, the 0 hours contracts, you know, used in big warehouses in the Midlands, used in a way that really took advantage of people. And there was a really great book by, was it James Bloodworth on it? 5-6 years ago. And also you get this periodic story of the exploitation of Indian women in Leicester and garment factories. And, you know, every few years you'll get a story saying, below minimum wage, terrible working conditions, isn't this awful? Nothing happens. 3 years later, you get the same story again. That all that stuff, probably illegal, no enforcement, which is why it keeps on happening. Anyway, all these stories are individual stories, but society sees them as being unjust. One of the big problems I think we have of our employment law, labour law system, is that the law essentially is about individual redress, but society sees it as a public good matter. And so you can't deal with a public good matter in a system which is basically about individual redress, and those who are most exploited actually can't afford to use it, really, unless they're part of a trade union. But unfortunately, many of the most vulnerable people aren't part of trade unions. Anyway, so my contention is the Employment Rights Bill is not very good because it contains lots of tactics, but it's not based on a strategy or political philosophy. That's why it doesn't work. That's why the government are being blown off course all the time. And that's why when they're proposing things, they end up coming up with very, very sort of technical, difficult ways of making it happen because it's not underpinned by a political philosophy. One of the things I think is very important when you talk about the Employment Rights Bill is Angela Rayner's speech, the TUC conference in 2023. I'd advise if you're going to have an exam question on it, you're going to answer it, read that speech, because that was the first time the Labour Party sort of made public pronouncements about the bill. One of the first things that was announced was that the bill would be published within 100 days. Now, when I heard that, my instant reaction was, but apparently it was said again. And when the bill was actually published, 97 days after Labour won the election, people in sort of groups, lobby groups, or like law society who do work in this area get invited to a call with senior civil servants to discuss what's going on. The first thing they said is like, we did this, we published this in 98 days. That was the thing they were most proud about. But obviously, a lot of the bill is half-baked. A lot of it involves implementation that needs to be discussed. A lot of it won't be implemented, if at all, until 2027 or 2028. So what's the point of publishing a bill that's half done, that won't be implemented until a lot later, and we don't even know how it'll be implemented? But that was one of the things that they were most proud about. And for me, I think that's a good example of how essentially the bill possibly has no soul, if that's a bit harsh, but probably has no soul. And then one of the other things I want to pick out as well, which was in Angela Rayner's speech, as well, she earlier on, and most of it is attacking the Tories, which is fair enough, it was before an election, and the TUC conference obviously likes all that stuff. And then she also mentions about no more empty slogans, which is always a very good empty slogan. And then towards the end of it, on page 9, she says, and there's even more. Day one basic rights, a ban of 0 hours contracts, an end to fire and rehire, and we can all hear everyone clapping and going, yes, isn't that brilliant? Absolutely no detail on how that'll be done or what that'll mean. Those three things, I'm going to talk about them in a little bit, they all sound really good in a speech, especially if you're attacking exploitative Tory bosses taking advantage of workers. But the reality of actually implementing them is super, super hard, especially, you know, in a system which is based on private redress. So what I'll do now is actually, maybe I'll talk about three of those aspects, and I'll talk about if I was a corporate lawyer and a client came to me and said, how can I get around these? And I'll talk about how I might get around these. This isn't legal advice. And I'm not over the detail of the bill because I've, unfortunately, 18 months ago, I was promoted out of the job I love. And now I have a lot more things to do and cover because I used to be an employment law expert in the Law Society. And now I'm a boss of a great team, but I have to do other things. Like after this, I'm going up to Newcastle to talk about the future of conveyancing, I'm happy to come back here and talk to about that as well if people want, but employment law is what I love. But what I'll do is I'll talk about three of those things, and I'll talk about the reality, maybe, of how I deal with those things. So day one, unfair dismissal rights. Now, that's gone now, which is good in many ways, because the problem with having day one unfair dismissal rights is you're creating a system which makes bosses potentially less interested in employing young people, people who don't look like them, taking what they perceive to be a risk. So what you're doing is you're saying, okay, so isn't it really unfair that somebody who's hired can then be sacked and there's no unfair dismissal reason? They can be bullied or they can be sacked for being smelly or something like that, and there's nothing you can do to come back. And that is really unfair. But actually, the bigger picture is allowing employers to essentially hire someone and have a time to assess whether there's a good fit or not actually allows employers to hire more easily. And so the 2 years was very, very, I think, you know, was way too long. My personal opinion is a year is about right, but 6 months is a great improvement. But at least with the moving back to 6 months, there's now sort of legal certainty about how the system operates. Because when the government, this was pointed out to the government about how day one rights actually could create potentially a very negative labour market for young people and people from ethnic minorities, they sort of started to develop this probation system, which would be light touch and still be rights, but not all the rights. And there'd be systems and all this place. And essentially started creating this really complicated system, which would be legally quite hard to sort of define and create and lead to more litigation. So on the banning of exploitative 0 hours contracts, I love the phrase exploitative 0 hours contracts, because if you're a socialist, you probably think all contracts of employment are exploitative. So again, there is how would you get around the banning of exploitative 0 hours contracts? Well, there's a couple of ways of doing. Does this pen work on this board? Is that okay? I'm going to draw very badly. It's not a saint.
It's one that is
made on
the whiteboard. So, otherwise,
I'll get sacked. Let's say you've got an issue. Let's say you've got, and this is an extreme example, but let's say you've got a company, a hotel that does weddings. Yeah, in the summer, they do lots of weddings on a Saturday. In the winter, they do hardly any. They obviously get a lot of 0 hours contracts people in because they say they don't really understand the sort of workflow, but maybe they do, maybe they don't. So how would I get around it? Well, there's two ways that I would try and get around it. So you have the hotel here, and what I would do is I would set up every single wedding as an individual company, so it's a one-off event. So that's how you do it. And maybe, and the hotel could be like a holding company. Maybe you set up a holding company which has a hotel and has all of these. And so actually, you could set up a sort of, and I think this is another sort of tip, if when you're looking at this, think about company law when you're thinking about enforcement within the employment law field. Because as has been pointed out, you know, company law structures can really affect how rights, employment law rights are put in place. So that's how I'd probably get around it. Or yes, you know, you create up your own agency, and then you could feed, like, say somebody who has lots of hot dog vans they turn their company into a bit of an employment agency, and then the people go to all the different hot dog vans, and then they work out that if somebody's been to this hot dog van for 3 or 4 weeks, maybe I'll send them to that hot dog van, and they're a different company. Now, this might be challenged in the courts, potentially employment tribunal, but firstly, because the legislation is so complicated and the employment tribunal takes so long to get through, the company will be like, well, yeah, this could be challenged. But if it takes 3 years, you know, for those 3 years, I can carry on operating this system. And if by the end of it, it looks like I'm going to lose, well, you know what, I'm going to wind this up. I'll wind up my company. So actually, there's no company to get money from. So I can carry on doing all of that. And from a company law perspective, I think that would be absolutely fine. And so there's no compensation to be paid. So even if the system that I've described is a bit dodgy legally, it's valid to try. And if it goes through and find out we end up losing the case, there's still a way where the employer can actually shut it all down so no compensation gets paid. And if you're on a 0 hours contract and if you're low paid, why would you go through that legal process? Just don't understand. Very quickly, on the negatives, on the fire and rehire stuff, how could that operate? Well, I think the problem with banning fire and rehire is it could lead to just firing for a start. But if I was going to sort of advise on how could I, let's say there's a situation where company A has been operating for a number of years, they pay 10 people £50,000 a year. Company B finds a cheaper way of doing it, paying everyone £30,000 a year. Company A is like, okay, I want to carry on my business because I've got a pretty good model, but salaries mean, you know, I'm not very competitive. What can they do? Well, what I would do is, first of all, with company A, I would probably, in all companies, I would take away any enhanced redundancy rights, statutory redundancy for everyone. Because then what you have is a potential for negotiation. You say to people, well, okay, we can't obviously fire and basically bring in an agency or new person on less money. But what we can do is, if you don't like working here, we can make you redundant, get you to sign a settlement agreement for a certain amount of money, so you can't basically sue us later on. So I'd probably try and take away all those rights in order to give me better leverage. You could also say, well, actually, there's going to be no increases in your salary for the next 5 years. You know, so you could create conditions within the workplace which essentially could lead to a negotiation period for them, you know, in order to sort of get the person to leave. And again, you could obviously already wind up. So, I mean, so there are sort of ways legally where companies who obviously afford a lot more legal advice can, you know, circumvent the law. Obviously, what I haven't discussed is trade unions. Trade unions are a great defence for workers. And so if in organisations where there are trade unions, obviously the workers have a better defence. But what I would also say, in organisations where there are trade unions and good trade unions, I think in most organisations, the trade union has a big sort of role in keeping the business functioning. So negotiations can, and collective negotiations isn't just about increasing pay each year. It's actually a good relationship between a union and a company is about saying, look, we have this economic problem. If we carry our lives in 5 years, we're not going to be, you know, solvent anymore. How do we get through this? And a good union would test the company's hypothesis, because they might say, well, if you're paying shareholders this amount of money, is that hypothesis true? But also has an interest in making sure that terms and conditions can be adapted to keep a business going. And my last thing that I'm going to talk about briefly is the positives of the bill. Okay, so it's too easy to go on about the negatives of the bill. And I agree with John, it's great that the bill's happening. So there's two positives. One very simple one is lifting the time period from three months to 6 months. 3 months from when you are sacked in order to make a claim was such a small period of time. And I think, to be honest, it stops negotiation and mediation. So hopefully lifting it to 6 months gives people more time to think about things and come to an agreement before going to the ET, maybe. I'm an optimist. So lifting it from 3 months to 6 months is a really good thing. And secondly, I want to talk about the Fair Work Agency. Now, I agree with John that there's a massive problem with funding, and is it going to be done properly? I am optimistic that Matthew Taylor's taken the role as chair, because Matthew Taylor did this big report, I'm going to say, 5-6 years ago. When you get old, everything's either 5 years or 10 years ago. Even if it's 20 years ago, you say it's 10 years ago. And he did this massive report called the Good Work Report. Again, I would advise everyone to have a skim read of that, especially the legal section of it, because I think that's great, but I'm biased on that bit. And he did this big report for Theresa May about how to improve the world of work. Now, there was a big hole in the report. He didn't discuss trade unions, which I think was interesting. So the report in itself is not the perfect report, but he is very committed to creating a good work environment through law and regulation. And the fact he's taken on the chairmanship of the Fair Work Agency suggests to me that he hopes he can push it somewhere, I would hope. Now, I want to go back to my original sort of comment about the public and the private. Now, for me, 0 hours contracts, the real issue is about the economic situation. So a 0 hours contract in central London, if you work in retail, well, actually, it's not overly exploitive because you have a lot of choice as a person. And there are lots of shops potentially that you can work at. If you have a 0 hours contract, if you're sort of live in the Midlands where there used to be coal mining, but there isn't anymore, and there's very little labour opportunities left. And the one is a big factory that supplies to companies and all this sort of stuff. And so there's one employer, and that employer does 0 hours contract. Now, that's fake 0 hours contract because there is no competition. There's no bargaining power on your side. And I think a regulator who has a bit of an economic outlook can go in there and say, actually, in this area, 0 hours contract should not exist, because actually the whole purpose of it, the idea behind 0 hours contract, is there is some level of negotiation between both sides rather than having complicated laws. So having a regulator who could do that, the Fair Work Agency can't do that, by the way, but that's just my sort of vision, would be useful. But where the Fair Work Agency might be able to come in is in situations where there is obviously something happening against the public good. Now, I'm going to use a hypothetical situation. This is a 100% hypothetical situation. There's an office in a company that's grown very big, still has a very dominant owner who created it, who essentially runs the board. In that, the owner is very handsy with young women and certainly behaves inappropriately with young women. In the head office, probably there's quite a high turnover of young women. Quite a lot of young women get employed, quite a lot of high turnover. Every now and again, there's a young woman who complains about the situation. What happens is the board sanctions a £100,000 payoff and a settlement agreement to be signed. Now, in that situation, obviously the matter is kept private, doesn't go to the ET. And for the person who's signing the settlement agreement, to be honest, their lawyer who's advising them, saying, well, yes, you can take this to the ET. It can be public. It'll take 2 or 3 years. You might win 80, 90, £100,000. But, you know, there's no guarantee of that. You have upfront legal costs and, you know, you're going to have to be living this situation for 2 or 3 years. Or you accept the £100,000 now, sign the settlement agreement. Nobody knows about it, especially in an industry where word of mouth is useful for getting employment. I think it'll be a very logical decision for the person to actually take the £100,000. But essentially, the public good is not being serviced because there still is an environment that's essentially dangerous for young women. Now, I would like a labour market enforcement agency to be able to come in and essentially go in and say, actually, you have an unsafe environment here, and be able to fine and publicly rebuke the company, but without stopping the individuals from getting the redress through the system that they need. So that is an example of how I think a good labour market agency can deal with the public good aspect of labour law, which is not at all dealt with law, but is in many people's consciousness. So anyway, so that's the end of my sort of little bit.
So I want to thank John and Nick for their brilliant presentations. I mean, you know, amongst them, I'm basically the lesser of the three, and you know me. So, and they basically made my points for me, which I didn't expect of Nick, actually. So since I'm basically just a scruffy-looking barbarian here from Greece, and Christmas is coming, instead of talking about the bill, I'm going to give you a fairy tale. So once upon a time, in the mountains of Anatolia, there was a poor villager with a large family. He was a poor farmer living in a very little sort of shed up in the mountains. Now, in that shed, it was himself, his wife, his three kids, and their newborn. So one day, the great powerful Hodza comes in. And the villager goes out and goes, "Oh, help me, oh powerful Hodza. I live in this very little shed. There's no space for us to live here. This, look at the destitution that we actually have to live in. Do something for us, please, help us." The Hodza goes, "Okay." And he brings two donkeys and shoves them into the little shed. And the villager goes, "What on earth are you doing? Now we have even less space, please help us." The baby's crying, right? The children are wailing. The Hodza goes around, brings in five pigs, shoves them in the shed. The villager starts crying, "Oh, great Hodza, now my shed is both small and smelly, and there's no space for us at all." The great powerful Hodza turns around, "Please help us." The great powerful Hodza turns around, brings two feather animals in. Long story short, by the end of the week, the shed is filled with animals, crying babies, filth from the outside world, sort of mud, the whole thing. The villager is there, desperate, right? He turns to the Hodza again and says, "Great Hodza, there's nothing for us left here. My shed is now both smelly and wet and cold. The pigs are basically sort of overtaking the donkeys. The donkeys are attacking the babies. Please help me." And the great powerful Hodza comes in and just takes out the animals, right? And the villager turns around and cries in sort of, you know, gratefulness to the great Hodza. And he goes, "Thank you, my village, my shed finally spacious. My shed is finally livable." That's exactly what the ERB is doing. So we spent a few decades basically shoving donkeys into the labor market, if you will, in the labor regulation. So effectively reducing labor standards. And when a new government just comes around and introduces a bill, suddenly you have a conservative and a progressive basically going that this is a good thing that a bill even exists, right? So that's the starting point. The second story I want to share with you is a personal story. I first met John 13 years ago at UCL. I was a youngish, right? I was a youngish postgraduate student at the time. And I had 10 years of practice on my back as an employment barrister, mainly in Greece. So we had a discussion and there were other students there as well. There were junior barristers there as well. At the end of that discussion, because I was the only one, remember what I told you at the beginning of the year, which is what Sarah is going to be banging on about next term as well, that as employment lawyers, yes, you need to be aware of politics, as Nick says, because it's a political subject, but you also need to be aware of what happens on the ground, right? You need to actually go into workplaces, talk to people in the place of work, in factories, talk to trade unions, because trade unions are important. So I had done all that. And apparently, it seems that I was the only one who had actually done that compared to junior barristers. So at the end of that event, John comes to me, gives me my card, and goes, "If you're fed up with this whole postgraduate thing, sort of come and find me in my chambers. There's a place for you in my chambers." And I was stupid enough to deny at the time, so sort of to basically sort of turn him down. But I was fed up at the time of practice. And I was like, okay, that's a generous offer, but I've just spent 10 years traversing company law, because exactly as Nick has said, it might be that you're spending, you know, ages in litigation, but at the end you cannot enforce anything if you have a very nebulous sort of set of companies. And I know that we keep telling you in lectures and supervisions that there are things such as the sham doctrine and lifting the corporate veil and all of that. That, ladies and gentlemen, in practice, I mean, I know what I've told you in the supervisions and lectures, but in practice, it's not as easy to do. So it's pretty sort of difficult to get a successful sort of claim through these kinds of means. And even if you do, as Nick said, it takes you forever to do so. And by the time you have managed to convince a tribunal to actually go your way, the company has managed to actually escape the whole thing. So enforcement, I had just spent 10 years so trying to actually get to enforce any successful claim. Second, I had spent 10 years trying to wrap my head around very sort of complicated bills and complicated acts that were constantly being reformed, and they were constantly being reformed through very shoddy bills with very sort of problematic, even numbering of reforms. If you see the Employment Rights Bill, that's exactly what it does. So it will take like 5 years for anyone to wrap their head around as to how this thing actually falls together. It's a patchwork. And I had also spent 10 years as a lawyer at the time. So because as a barrister, you're both a psychologist, you're a shrink, you're a delivery boy, you're a soldier, you know, to cry on, and you also sort of have to actually make a proper argument in court. And I had actually sort of gone through a system of individual sort of remedies, if you will. So private enforcement. And through private enforcement, Nick was absolutely right. Unless you're a member of a trade union, you lack the funds to basically enforce your rights. So you fall through the cracks. So imagine my surprise. And that's why I left practice, right? And turned into academia. So imagine my surprise when 13 years later, I have a major case of deja vu. Because suddenly, I left Greece to avoid all that nonsense, and here we are having to go through the exact same nonsense. So the Employment Rights Bill is, yes, it exists. Fun. But on the other hand, I mean, there are multiple problems with it. One is that it's very technical and complicated. It's going to be ridiculously difficult, not just for individual employees and workers, but there are representatives, so trade union representatives, and the lawyers to manage to actually sort of traverse themselves through its provisions. Secondly, the devil hides in the detail. So as you've heard already, so the Employment Rights Bill does not scrap zero-hour contracts, for example. It attacks exploitative zero-hour contracts. What on earth are those? Who knows? The idea is that instead of scrapping zero-hour contracts, so going the way that other jurisdictions have gone, like Ireland, for example, they're trying to introduce this idea of guaranteed hours. And as we discussed, one of the amendments that the Lords managed to push in is that we'll only be sort of entitled to zero-hour contract to guaranteed hours, sorry, if you request it, right? Now, the Commons fought back by going, well, yes, that is unacceptable because of the inherent imbalance of power. So you can't expect an employee to actually negotiate and request or reject. But at the same time, the original version of the bill provides that an individual employee can basically, an individual worker can basically reject that guarantee of minimum hours. So is that waiver absolutely free? Is there no inherent imbalance of power there? With regards to fire and rehire, again, what's being sort of the original manifesto, if you will, wanted to basically abolish fire and rehire. Instead of that, we get the regulation of unscrupulous fire and rehire. Now, what does that mean? It basically means that companies are absolutely free to actually go through a fire and rehire process if they are genuinely in economic peril. Now, the problem is that the Employment Rights Bill provides that there are various conditions that need to be taken into account as to whether that is the case. But again, enforcement, right? The assessment of those conditions happens ex post, not ex ante. So, for example, a good sort of use of a fair work agency would have been to have a fair work agency that works as an ex-ante mechanism of sort of assessment of such criteria. There are similar frameworks in Europe. I mean, a good example has been collective redundancies and transfers of undertakings mechanisms in other jurisdictions. So you might come across a case, Aget Iraklis, in your EU law, sort of courses this year, that exactly illustrates that point, that you might have a labor inspectorate that basically jumps into before people are dismissed in order to assess whether the employer genuinely is in peril. So even under the current iteration of the bill, right, in fire and rehire, in a scrupulous fire and rehire circumstances, the remedy is that you simply go through the proper and fair dismissal procedure, the regular and fair dismissal procedure, right? So in the end, all you get at the end, at best, is compensation, right? So as you heard earlier, a more effective way of going about it would have been an injunction. So the idea, again, is that you have all these provisions, But enforcement is problematic in all of them, which takes us back to what we're discussing earlier in term when we discussed the third way, right? In 1990, in the late 1990s, we had another case of introduction of minimum standards and valiant rights, and everybody went hooray, right? The problem in that period as well was one of enforcement. It was that the devil was hiding in the details, and we have just more on that. And I'll let you sort of, I'll finish with sort of a point that Catherine made, that this was a perfect opportunity to have a bill that caters to modern employment relationships, right? So we have been discussing things like digital work, algorithmic management. I mean, indeed, some of these things like platform work regulation have been, you know, are even obsolete nowadays in other countries. I mean, we spent 15 years trying to regulate platform working. That actually happened in Europe with the Platform Work Directive. And the British government, with its golden opportunity to do something about it and sort of regulate the future, does nothing in the ERB. And the fact is that they didn't have to invent the wheel, to reinvent the wheel. They could have actually looked to other instances of relevant regulation. AI. AI is the sexy subject du jour, right? But AI is used in algorithmic control of individuals. Nothing in the ERB. So what that indicates, that we are bound to have further employment rights reforms, we are bound to have them in the next 5 to 10 years, precisely because of the technological and sort of economic development. So, and again, we will be discussing new ERBs, equally complex, equally sort of obscure, and then at the end, hopefully, you won't stand in my place. I mean, by that time, hopefully you won't be miffed and turned to academia. If you are, I mean, on the upside, we'll get more brilliant employment law academics here better than us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed for all of those comments. The good news is there's going to be lots more law. The bad news is there's going to be lots more law. We've got a couple of minutes for questions. So if anyone would like to ask our wonderful panel any questions?